So we're back. State Board will come back to order. The next item on the agenda is one that's always fun and enjoyable and an honor to participate in. It's the recognition of the 2015 Millikan Educator for Colorado. Interim Commissioner asked, we'll turn it over to you to conduct the ceremony.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. This is indeed quite a pleasure. I'll talk a little bit more about the how wonderful it was to be there at the actual ceremony, but let me ask Associate Commissioner Alyssa Pearson to come forward and present this award.
Good afternoon. This afternoon, we will honor Mr. Ryan Moore, our 2015 Colorado Millikan Educator. We have provided you with brochures about this program, but let me give you a little background on this award. The Millikan Educator Award provides recognition and an unrestricted financial award of $25,000 to exceptional elementary and secondary school teachers, principals, and specialists who are furthering excellence in schools throughout the country. Each year, exceptional educators are considered without their knowledge by a blue ribbon panel appointed by each state's Department of Education. Jane Goff generously served on our panel this year. Thank you, Jane. The recipient is caught unaware with the news of their $25,000 award, which they can use in any way they choose. The announcement is made during a surprise assembly attended by students and peers, as well as federal, state, and local officials and the media. On October 29th, Ryan Moore of Liberty Point International School in Pueblo, Colorado, was named the 2015 Colorado Millikan Educator. Interim Commissioner asked helped to present the award with Lowell Millikan and the Millikan Family Foundation. I will show you a short video, a clip of a portion of the award assembly, and then tell you a bit more about Mr. Moore.
Sound? I sit in the back row. I see there's a frown on my face.
It's really nice that teachers know their value, so this is a big deal. This is such a special day for educators. To have these teachers feel honored in this way is just incredible.
As a Millikan educator, you are given a platform from which to grow yourself and to help other teachers and other children Mr. Moore was presented with a $25,000 check from the Millikan Family Foundation in recognition of his exceptional work as a model teacher for the state and the nation. He has been teaching for 7 years and is currently an 8th grade science teacher at Liberty Point International School. Prior to teaching, Mr. Moore served as a staff sergeant in the U.S. Army during Operation Iraqi Freedom and as a corrections officer with the Colorado Department of Corrections. At Liberty Point International School, he's known as a highly creative teacher who focuses on real-world applications of science. He's paired students for
We're having all sorts of technical fun this afternoon. He's paired students for genealogy exercises, encouraging them to imagine what their offspring would look like, incorporated ping pong into a class on Newton's laws, dressed up as George Mendel and teaching genetics, and taught atomic structure using black lights and glow-in-the-dark constellations. More than once, students have told him that he has made all the difference for them as they are entering high school because he believed in them and encouraged them to succeed. Mr. Moore's long-range potential is evidenced by his enthusiasm and passion for students and education. He loves what he does, and his excitement is evident on a daily basis in his classroom. Interim Commissioner Asp, would you like to say a few words about the day?
Yes, I would. I've had the pleasure to attend several of these Millikan Award ceremonies, both as a district administrator and then in this role. This one was particularly special. I'll talk more about why that is in a second. You saw some of it in the video. This is a total surprise, as you heard. When you pull up to the school, no one knows about this except the principal, maybe a couple of district officials. The only thing the school knows is there's an assembly. We're going down to the gym. And also our CDE staff, Lynn Bamberry, and her staff do this incredible job of setting this up. And I don't know if Lynn's still in here or not. Yes, she does a great job with this, and it's so well orchestrated. But you drive to the school, and there's these huge limos out front that belong to Lowell Millikan. He's quite wealthy, and it looks like the president's there. and they've got several people with little walkie-talkie things in their ear. But to make long story short, I was the foil. I had to go there and say, hi, I'm here just to, you have a great school, and isn't it wonderful that we're here? And then I go, there's one other thing we want to tell you. And then I introduce Lowell Millikan, and he walks out and talks for a while, and no one still knows why he's there, and all of a sudden he says, here's what we're here to do. And he announces the name, unbeknownst to anybody. I mean, your wife wasn't able to be, I mean, no one knows about this, except a couple of people, and the place goes, it didn't do justice here, it goes berserk in the most wonderful way. And the coolest part here, there's two really cool parts about this piece. I have to get my Kleenex out on this one. Is first of all, because Ryan's daughter is in his class, she's there to watch her dad get this award. People are going nuts, and it's great. And here's the other cool part. What you saw him talking on there usually is reserved for football players or something else. And they will, you know, give them their due. But here's somebody that makes this incredible difference in the lives of kids. And all these cameras and reporters are in his face asking him all these questions. He was the celebrity, and it was terrific and so well-deserved. And then the last thing Lowell Millikan says is, hey, kids, when you're thinking about growing up, think about being a teacher. Pretty cool stuff. So congratulations, Ryan. It was a wonderful day for me.
I would now like to present the 2015 Colorado Millikan Educator, Mr. Ryan Moore, with an obelisk from the Millikan Foundation, and have him say a few words.
Hello. I'm going to do like my kids. I keep notes on my phone. I was like, why are kids always doing that? And then I'm like, that's pretty cool. So I started acting like my kids. All right, so thank you guys very much. Chair Enderman and the rest of the board, just thank you so much for recognizing me. We don't get recognized very often as teachers, just when you get in trouble. This is when we get recognized. So this is really awesome. So the Millikan Foundation has been a huge blessing, obviously. I had to go figure out what all those words meant, because I was like, what's that mean about the tour? Are we going to get a new computer lab? And Dilka's like, that's yours. Like, so getting recognized by them and then like having them back, it is so shocking. It was just amazing. But anytime you get recognized, you immediately have to look back and see who's been helping you, who's been supporting you. So I have a short list here of people that even though they're not here, I just have to say who they are and what they've done for me real quick. So some of them are here. Now, first of all, the Millikan Foundation, I'm so excited to be accounted among their members now, because there's people that I didn't even know. I've been following them. There's people who I have lesson plans from who were a Millikan Foundation Award winner 20 years ago, and I'm like, wow, I've been following you this whole time, and now I'm with you. It's very amazing. Just to be put in that group is a huge blessing. So I just want to thank them. Mr. Dilka, my principal, Brian Dilka, I want to thank him because he took a risk on me. I was a teacher in residency, which means I didn't go through your traditional teacher school. I went and learned all my science stuff, and then later I'm like, I'd like to teach science. And so he gave me an opportunity. I went to college for that, and we worked it out. And so I really appreciate you doing that. You make it easy for me to be creative in my classroom, and I'll keep following you because of that, because you make my job easy, and you took a risk. So I'll keep working for you. Devin Burke, he paired me up with Devin Burke. She's this kooky chemistry teacher at the high school level, and she's been my mentor for 2 years, and if I have problems, I still call her. And she taught me how to teach by the state standards, and that sounds dumb, but it makes it really easy. You just look at what you're supposed to teach and then do it, and she was able to convey that to me, and so I use that every day. My 8th grade team, Mrs. Stevens, Mrs. Boley, Miss Valencia, and Mrs. Zamora, We just became an IB school, and so we went through all these changes, and we had to do all this stuff, and we implemented all these new amazing things, and they're with me the whole way doing that, and I'm so much better a teacher now because of all the things we've done over the last 2 years. My partner across the hall, Mr. Paycheck, he's a reading teacher for sixth grade, and anytime I do something, he's always like, hey, you know, if you added this much, you'd have like 9 more things covered. So I'm like, yeah! And so all these people are making me better teachers, and it's showing up here. My students... the students at our school are working so hard for us, and they don't even know it. Over the past 3 years, we implement new things and new things and new things. And slowly but surely, they're doing stuff that their siblings who came through never even had a chance to do. And they have no idea how hard they're working for us. We just keep adding stuff and changing things and moving forward. And so with the new rigor, they just keep being successful. And so I got to thank them, because that's what makes, when you're teaching, if your kids are getting it, it really, it makes all the difference in whether you want to go to work or not. And they're getting it. So they're working hard for us. My wife and family, they support me. When you're a teacher, there's time. You lose your time. There's finances. It's not a huge paycheck. And then the biggest thing is emotions. Like, they know that you're emotionally invested in kids and stuff at work. And sometimes it doesn't work out for them. Sometimes it does. But I just really appreciate them. Love you, Tammy. This is my wife. She's super supportive. And I got to thank God, because this is just the cherry on top of my already amazing life. I mean, he's blessed me so much. And then the last thing I want to end with here is... like, we didn't talk about school improvements or the new programs we're running, but I really want to talk to you about what my school does best, and that's relationships. Mr. Dilke really pushes that we have relationships with kids, and it used to be a big program and a big thing we did, and it was all systematic. But over the last 3 years, it's accidental. And I see kids every day making relationships with adults that they're in the classroom, they're helpful, but I mean just life-wise. It's crazy to see how the teachers in my building are reaching kids and just changing their lives, because some of our demographics, a rough demographic, they need adults who care about them. So just it's just kind of crazy, and I'm so thankful that my children, including the children at our school, but my actual children have come through the school, and I'm just so thankful they came through, because I know they're prepared for high school and what's coming in life. But the most thing I'm thankful for is that they came through the school, and they know they're loved, and that's what they're going to take away from their middle school experience. So... just thank you guys so much, and once again, thank the Milken Foundation, but that's kind of a little bit about my school and where I'm at.
Thank you.
Okay. We're going to have you come forward and do a picture with the commissioner and Joyce Rankin, who's your representative.
Yep, we've
been.
Thank you. That was good.
Okay, April will come back to order, and we're going to start now with 14, item 14, a rulemaking hearing. Let's see. State Board of Education will now conduct a public rulemaking hearing for the rules for the administration of the waiver statute and rule 1 CCR 301-35. The board approved the notice of rulemaking at its October 7, 2015 board meeting. A hearing to promulgate these rules was made known through the publication of a public notice on October 25, 2015 through the Colorado Register and by the State Board notice on December 2, 2015. The board is authorized to promulgate these rules pursuant to 22-2-207, (1) percent CCRS. Commissioner Asp, is the staff prepared to provide an overview? And I would observe that no one has signed, has taken the opportunity to sign for testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Cherry. These rules, similar to the ones earlier today, are technical cleanups. They involve the waivers of statute and rule regarding charter schools, and Gretchen Morgan, Associate Commissioner, will take us through these.
Great, thank you. So, as Dr. Asp indicated, these were brought to us from the Office of Legislative Legal Services, and this is because there was a change in statute around charter waiver processes that happened actually two sessions ago, and it really had three parts. One was that, and I think we're all thankful for this one, it changed the definition of what is an automatic waiver, so they became truly automatic, so that when you were a school with a contract, you do have those waivers, which meant the department didn't have to have processes with those anymore, and neither did you. The second change it made was to change the list of things that were not allowed by this board to be identified as automatic. And the idea is that that list could be revisited over time, but there were some that in consultation with the League of Charter Schools were identified as things that where people sometimes getting those waivers in a way where they had no interaction with anyone and truly automatic way would set them up for risk. This would be things like sometimes charter schools were confused when getting a waiver to licensure that they thought they maybe weren't accountable to highly qualified, and then at some later date they would have employed people not having met highly qualified requirements. We then do the data collection around highly qualified, and they find out, oh my gosh, they have a person that they can't employ in a position. And so to try and prevent that kind of confusion, those kinds of things were named as being not allowed by this board to be identified in the automatic list once that automatic thing became truly automatic, so it would ensure some communication happened with schools so that they wouldn't accidentally get into situations like that. The third thing that changed was the statute and the rules had previously referred to a form provided by CDE as part of what you had to submit to get waivers. And at the time, the sort of legislative intent about this was to try and make this process as simple as possible. And so they asked the question, do they need to have a separate form? Isn't there some place these waivers and replacement plans are already listed? And the answer was yes, they're already listed in the contract. And so the statute was changed. Instead of saying that we would provide a form and they would submit a contract and assign board resolution, it just said it would have a complete, like fully executed and complete contract, which included their identified waivers and replacement plans. So this revision of rules, you know, again, was, I think, in some ways more given to us from the legal services group. And it's all of this, I think, is fine and meets legislative intent pretty smoothly. We didn't receive any feedback from anyone in the field about this either before today. But there is one, like, really tiny, unanticipated wrinkle in here that I just want to note for you. I don't think there's a way for us to fix it today, actually, and we've been in discussion with the league about this, but when someone wants to get a waiver that's not on their normal contract renewal cycle, right, so for example, this fall you got a bunch of waivers from schools seeking school readiness waivers because it was a new requirement, not because it was time for them to renew their contract. This change of statute, by trying to remove the other things that made it burdensome, like having a form means that when they want to come off cycle, they actually have to formally amend their contract to be able to submit that contract to us, because that's now the only requirement in law is that they bring the contract. So this is, again, I think accidental, annoying, and probably not something that we can fix in rule, because the statute says this very clear thing. The league is aware of this. The league is interested in trying to figure out at a later date if they can come up with clever ideas about things you might all be able to do in rule to fix that. We've so far not been able to come up with something that has passed muster in these conversations. Or they may take this back for a legislative fix, which I think they feel pretty comfortable taking on, which would require us to just amend these rules again if they were able to get that legislation. So again, I just want to be totally clear with you that, you know, I think there is an accidental annoying thing in here. I think the league, which is the advocacy group for charter schools, is on top of it and will do things to help. But that today this probably is what we can do, which is just to get our rules in alignment with law so that we are not in trouble with the legal services office. So these are the rules before you.
Okay. Any questions from members of the board? Yes, Dr. Scheffel.
Sure. In terms of like 2.02E, the Children's Internet Protection Act, is that there because we needed to put something in there in terms of data privacy, or is that what's stipulated goes there? Just trying to figure out what prompted that language.
I think that just is in law, and our rules did not reflect what was in law.
So it just didn't have that?
Yep. It was missing, and they caught it.
Could I ask the same question about 2.08K, the use of on-site peace officers, school resource officers? Is it 2.06? I'm sorry, 2.06K.
Oh, thank you.
Is that the same thing? We had to put that language in there, or some
yes,
other language?
These are just aligning with what is in statute.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, we didn't suggest any additions. Staff didn't make any suggestions. These came straight from legal counsel.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, any further questions regarding this rule change? This rule, by and large, affects our own procedures more than anything else, correct?
Yes, that's right.
No real effect on the outside world other than when they can do things.
That's right. It really just is what they have to bring to us so that we can then bring things to you. And again, the goal was to really simplify. Like I said, this one little glitchy thing was very much accidental. And I trust that the league and others will be able to fix that. It's not horrible either. It's just annoying.
Great. Thank you. Are we ready for a motion?
Sure.
Dr. Schroeder?
I move to approve the rules for the administration of the waiver of statute and rule.
Is there a second? There's a second, Ms. Masley. Is there objection to the adoption of that motion? Seeing none, that motion is declared adopted unanimously. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now the next item is item 15. And we're a whole half hour early, so why don't we try to go to start with
this time.
Let's see, where are we?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
If I may, a couple of items that we could potentially move forward would be items either 16.01, the ESEA reauthorization briefing, or item 23.01, reducing regulation and red tape.
Let's do 16 first, why don't we?
Okay.
And what was the other one?
23.01.
23, got it. Thank you. All right, let's try 16. Commissioner Asp, is that your item primarily?
I'd like to introduce it.
All right. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We wanted to give you an update on the reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. That act was actually reauthorized by vote of the Senate earlier today, passed by the House a week or so ago. It was a very strong bipartisan vote to support this reauthorization bill. A couple pieces, Alyssa Pearson and Pat Chapman will take you into more of the details. This is a very lengthy bill, so we're not going to get into all the details,
really?
But there's some things we wanted you to know about it. And the reason you're getting a PowerPoint right now, because the bill passed this morning, and we wanted to make sure that we had to. There's some things we could change if we needed to. A couple things that I point out to you that we're excited about. One is some flexibility around state assessments that's offered through a pilot provision that you'll hear more about here. Seven states have the opportunity to engage in different ways of looking at assessment. If not, the assessment regulations are similar to what we have in place now. They changed a little, and Ms. Pearson will talk about that. The other side of it is more specification about what accountability needs to look like, but we think in a very freeing way that you'll hear more about from some local districts this afternoon. But essentially what this bill calls for is for states to have an accountability system that includes other indicators or other measures than student achievement measures. For example, school climate or opportunity to learn or a number of other pieces that we'll learn more about what that means, but it's required now when this bill is implemented. It's required to have a student achievement portion and accountability and another indicator that the states can choose from that will go into that piece. And we have districts, we've been working with them, who are looking at that process right now. So these are very timely for us. You'll hear about an assessment pilot a little later on today as well. So with that, let me turn it over to Alyssa.
Good afternoon. So again, sorry for the last minute PowerPoint. We just wanted to make sure we had all the information that was up there this morning. So I've been reading through all day long. So a little bit of an overview about where we got this bill is ESSA. It's Every Student Succeeds Act. And that's a compromise bill that was created through the conference committee of the Every Child Succeeds Act from the Senate and the Student Success Act from the House. Combined it together, Every Student Succeeds Act. The House approved it last week on December 2nd on a 359-64 vote. The Senate approved this morning, 85-12. It's scheduled to be on the President's desk before the end of the year. I've read some things today that said by this Friday. I've read other things that said by the 17th, so it'll be quick, it seems like. Waivers will be implemented through August 1st of 2016. So in the meantime, while we're waiting for that transition, the waiver that you all just approved and the U.S. Department of Ed just approved for us will be what we implement for the rest of the school year. The implementation timeline for ESSA is the programs will be implemented for the most part in 2016-17, next school year, and the accountability will start taking place in 2017-18. So there's a time to do some adjustment. There's a lot of work that needs to get done that we'll talk about in a little bit. Once the bill is formally signed and passed into law, before it can really, some pieces of it can really be implemented. So let me go over assessment requirements. For the most part, they are the same, but there's a few changes that give some more flexibility in the state. So grades 3 through 8 and once in high school are still required for English, language, arts, and math. The change is, though, that they'll allow for grade 9 to count as high school, and that was a area that we've had some conversation with the U.S. Department of Ed and that the legislature's been really interested in, especially last session. 1323 asked for permission to use our ninth grade test as our high school assessment. U.S. Department of Education didn't allow for that. But now with this change in law, you could use the ninth grade test that we have in place as the high school assessment. Science is required to be assessed once per grade level, just as it is now, and those grade spans are 3 through 5, 6 through 9, and 10 through 12. So the science didn't get the ninth grade adjustment. You may be able to use a nationally recognized high school academic assessment at the high school level. Think about like 11th grade at ACT might be an option there. Assessments may be computer adaptive. That's a new change. So think about like the NWA maps to kind of assessments that adjust to define where kids are at in terms of grade level. Something like that would be allowed. The bill also includes assessment notification requirements like what we have in 1323 that parents need to be notified and have access to what the assessment requirements are for the state and for the district. And it also includes funds for audits of state assessments and local assessments. So if you want to use some of the funds allocated through there, you can use that to audit, see, you know, kind of get a sense of what assessments you're giving and why and if there's room for reduction or streamlining things. Some additional assessment requirements. We're going to talk about opt-out because we know that's been a very timely conversation. The bill requires still the 95% participation rate overall and for all disaggregated groups. So that didn't change in there. How that 95% requirement is factored in accountability is left up to states to determine. So kind of where we got with the waiver is what we understand right now. But, again, there needs to be a regulatory process, and the U.S. Department of Ed is going to need to interpret what they believe in the law, but that what's written is kind of where we're at with them right now through the waiver. And it explicitly allows states to have opt-out laws and that those need to be recognized and addressed. Additionally, there's an assessment pilot option, like Dr. Asp talked about. 7 states are going to be allowed to participate in a pilot to pilot some different options for assessment systems, similar to like what New Hampshire has in place right now. So to think about more performance-based, more embedded assessments in the instruction curriculum, just different ways that we could look at that. So we'll talk to you more about that later this afternoon, as well as the districts that are coming to talk about the Student-Centered Accountability Project. So this really paves the way for us to move forward with some of the ideas and processes the state was already coming up with and districts were already coming up with. Okay, in terms of accountability, we're fairly similar to where we are right now. And again, it kind of where we've been going with the accountability work group and suggestions for improving and enhancing the school and district performance frameworks, we're really going in that direction. So what the bill requires in terms of accountability requirements, first looking at achievement on tests, on state tests, which is a component we already have, but looking at that data disaggregated, which is not something we had been doing specifically, that achievement disaggregation for accountability purposes, but it's where the work group and where the recommendations have been going anyway. Then looking at English language proficiency on in the accountability framework too, which is something that we already do. You include the English language proficiency growth in our accountability frameworks. Then it asks for an additional academic factor that's disaggregated. That's where they would see growth being put into place. So we're a state that has valued growth pretty highly in the past, and that's where you would fit in growth if you wanted to continue to do that. And then finally, this is where Dr. Asp was talking about the other system quality indicator. So this is a different kind of measure than what we've had as a state currently in terms of what we look at for accountability and for points. It could be student engagement, educator engagement, access or completion of advanced coursework. There's a lot of options that could be there right now. The results must be disaggregated and looked at that way, but we'll be able to take some of the conversations we've already had with stakeholders with their ideas about where they'd like to move forward and how to broaden how we look at accountability, and take those as recommendations to bring to you all as we figure out how we want to implement this. Again, we have till the 2017-18 school year, so there's plenty of time for stakeholder input there. And finally, high schools, you need to include graduation rate, which is something we already do. And it allows for the extended graduation rates that we do in Colorado. Like we talked about before, participation needs to be a consideration. This was a change that was happening in some of the negotiation of the bill. At one point, that was included as part of the calculations. Now it's the participation needs to be considered, but it doesn't need to be 4 points. It's up to states to figure out how that participation rate is considered in. So that's another conversation we'll need to have as a state. School identification and support is similar to how it's been through the waiver process. It's a little bit different, but it's very different than how it was under No Child Left Behind with adequate yearly progress. So states are required to identify at least once every 3 years and address the lowest performing 5% of schools. And then schools where less than 2/3 of students graduate, and schools with struggling disaggregated groups of students. And so how states intervene, how they address that, first it's really left to districts to do for a while, and then if districts are not seeing progress, if we're not seeing progress with the schools, then the state has a little bit more of a role there. But the performance challenges are asked to be addressed with evidence-based interventions. So the U.S. Department of Ed has had regulations around the school improvement grants that have been very specific. They've had 5 very specific models for how those funds could be spent and what needed to happen for turnaround schools. That is not in the bill. I think it's prohibited from being, I don't know. That was one of the
USD can't prescribe
it. So it's really left up again to states and LEAs about how that looks. 7% of the state's Title I funds are to be set aside for the school improvement efforts. There's no longer separate grants, but there's a requirement the funds are set aside, but how those are used and what models are really left up to the states. And then in terms of educators, this is another area where the law is very different from both the waiver and No Child Left Behind. There's no requirement for teacher evaluation like what we had in the waiver, but you may states and districts may use the funds to support that work if they choose to. And then the highly qualified teacher requirement that we had under No Child Left Behind is completely gone. But the states and LEAs and schools must report on teacher qualifications. So we have the reporting piece, but that highly qualified requirement is gone.
Okay. With regard to, so the major changes were really, I think, in the accountability provisions and the support for low performing schools. The existing program structure, that's the current structure under No Child Left Behind, is largely maintained. We still have a Title I, a Title II, Title III. A lot of the summaries mention the elimination of, I think 49 programs, and I saw 64 programs. The vast majority of those programs were never funded to begin with, so it's not we're not necessarily taking a huge hit there. However, there are some programs, some significant programs that have been eliminated under the new law. Among those are the Reading First is no longer there. The Math and Science Partnership is eliminated. The school turnaround grants have been eliminated. The EdTech grant has been eliminated. A couple of those haven't been funded for several years anyway. In other cases, there have been programs that have been sort of combined into a new program. And then the newest program that really didn't exist under No Child Left Behind is the Early Childhood Preschool Development Program.
You all also have a handout where we listed, we borrowed it from the internet, all the programs that are in there and the allocations. The
authorization level, so it's the Committee for Education Funding. They've sort of listed the major programs and the authorization levels for the next several years, and in some cases they provide a comparison of current funding levels. Overall, the increases in funding are pretty minor. In some cases it's level funding, and in other cases it's a slight decline in funding from current levels. There are a couple of new programs, as I mentioned, that sort of help defray the impact of the cuts that we'll be experiencing. With regard to Title I and Title II allocations, for Title I allocations, there was a lot of discussion in conference and prior to conference in the House and Senate regarding Title I portability. Title I portability did not make the cut. It's not provided for in the new bill. There is, however, a pilot program that they'll be work with up to 50 school districts on, where they can basically pool all of their federal funds and allocate it to their schools based on poverty. So if they can sort of experiment with alternative ways to allocate their federal funds locally. In general, the Title I funding formula is really unchanged. For Title II state allocations, they're adjusting the poverty level or the weighting of poverty in the allocations to states. Theoretically, that should lead to rural areas receiving more funding, and I think that's maybe not necessarily going to be the case in Colorado. From what I read, that a lot of that was sort of for southern states, where a lot of the poverty is in the rural areas. That's not necessarily the case in Colorado. We don't know exactly how that'll play out, but if it will be helpful to our rural school districts. For Title IV, one of the changes is that 21st Century School Community Learning Centers will continue to be funded at pretty much the current rate that it's been funded. But there's a new Title IV. For those of you who don't know, there used to be a Title IV under No Child Left Behind, Safe and Drug-Free School in Schools and Communities. That funding for that program ran out, I think, at least 4 years ago. So we've not been receiving those funds for several years. The new law creates, sort of blocks together a number of programs into a Title IV Part A, Student Support and Academic Achievement Grant. There are some requirements associated with that grant and how that's spent locally, with some minimum levels and maximum levels for how local school districts can spend those funds. And there is still a Title IV Part B, which is the Community Learning Center grant. There's and I think has been, and Gretchen can correct me, I think it's been Title V, it's the charter school grant is now in Title IV, and there's good funding for that, and I think to a certain extent, expansion of that program. But just sort of to quickly run through those, so there's still Title I, which is, improved instruction, math and English language arts instruction for kids who are at risk of non-proficiency. Still Title II funds to strengthen the educator workforce. Still Title III funds for moving kids to English language proficiency and academic proficiency. And return of some funding for safe and drug-free school type activities, anti-bullying and those kinds of things. And then still the Title IV 21st century schools. States still will have the opportunity to consolidate these programs into a single application and have some broad discretion in the questions that we ask of districts in trying to access those funds. As was mentioned earlier, the Senate did approve approve the new bill today. It's expected to go to the president's desk soon for signature. The president is expected to sign it. Once it's signed, really there's a year that's allowed for the regulatory process. There's some text in there that suggests that things that haven't been open to the regulatory process in the past will be open to the regulatory process under this new bill, which could be not necessarily a great thing for us, because I think in some ways it gives the U.S. Department of Education an opportunity to create details that may not necessarily exist in statute. So we're going to really want to monitor that process carefully and be a participant in that process. As I said, it's a year-long process. They will, if the bill is signed this year, they would have until December of next year to wrap up that process. We will have an opportunity to provide input into that regulatory process, and we intend to do that. State plans are due to the U.S. Department of Education by July 1. I don't think that'll be a huge lift for CDE because we've been doing this waiver thing. I think what we'll be asked to provide to them are similar to the kinds of things that we've had to provide for the ESEA flexibility waiver, in addition to a whole lengthy list of assurances that we'll be asked to provide. It does require the State Board of Education's approval and also the development of our plan. Written into the law that there's a requirement that the governor have an opportunity to review our plan, and I think has up to 30 days to either not respond or to sign off on that plan. And I think that's it.
Do you have questions? Pat and I have been trying to work our way through the 1,000-plus pages.
I'm on page like 300. It's over 1,000.
I've been skipping around.
Over 1,000 pages.
Why don't we just start by going around the room? We'll start.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to point out, in terms of the accountability and the assessment provisions of this bill, I think Colorado is very well poised to be a leader in the country on this. As you'll hear later on this afternoon, we have a group of districts that have already been exploring in detail how they could add additional measures to accountability, and we're excited to support that, and I'll ask the department this afternoon for some additional support. And then we've also been having conversations with districts about assessment pilots that could help us reduce the state assessment burden and turn more of it over to local assessments. You'll hear some districts talk about their interest in that this afternoon as well. So we feel well poised to make good use of the flexibility that's here.
Okay, why don't we just start? We'll just go around the room. Dr. Schroeder.
So I just want to talk about money. For the seven state pilot, is there funding that goes with that to help the districts? This is not a light lift.
Yeah.
I don't believe so, but I'm not sure.
I think you can use the assessment money you get.
Oh, that's right. I think it does say that.
Extra,
so,
right?
So states get some. There's we have been receiving money for state assessments, administration, development of state assessments. I think it does say that you can set aside some of those funds in support of that pilot process.
Okay. So then I see the funding stuff that you handed out. And if I read it correctly, these are the big dollars. This is not Colorado. I mean,
that's
national
authorization.
I'd like to think this.
2.5 times our budget.
How do we figure out? First of all, is everything divided in the same way? so that we have roughly 900,000 kids of that, what, how many
we
poor kids?
Can,
free and reduced lunch
so it's all relative poverty. So
right, so it's our free and reduced lunch kids.
Well, it's from census, and we'll be talking more about that during a presentation tomorrow with regard to how Title I funds are allocated, come to states, and are allocated to school districts. But typically, for Title I, we're somewhere between 1 and 2% of the state, the national appropriation. So we're trying to use some of the numbers of where we are, the relative amount that we get currently, and try and project how much money we might be able to get, or we might get, likely get, under the new law. So, for example, there's a pretty minor increase to Title I that's called for by this bill. We've been receiving around $150 million under Title I. We would expect to maybe get a slight increase to Title I.
Mr. Chair, could I add one piece to that and ask Mr. Chapman to correct me? So if you're in a school district, your Title I allocation depends on the poverty rate in your counties that you serve. It's not about the school district itself necessarily. Am I correct in that?
Well, we do receive allocations from the U.S. Department of Education at the district level, and then we're required to make adjustments to those allocations based on what's in statute. The way it it's based on residence, where the kids live, and then versus where those kids are served.
Help me understand what that.
What the, yeah. So when they use census data and they look at the percent the numbers and percentages of families living in poverty within a geographic area.
Is it a county or a district?
It's they use county information, but they actually have our district maps, and so they're able to give us district level allocations from the U.S. Department of Education, and then we make adjustments to those allocations.
Because right. We have very few city and county and school district.
Yeah. That where the county and the district are the same. Yes.
But
they have.
But you feel it does come pretty close to district by district, as opposed to
they give us so they have a map of our district boundaries, and they provide district level allocations to us, and then we make adjustments.
And it's based on where the kids live, not what district they attend.
Correct.
That's the one of the backpack issues.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the report.
Okay, Jane, any questions?
Not just yet.
Okay. Joyce.
I'm not sure whether this applies, but if this is new, how is that going to align with our state laws from last year? And you probably don't have that answer, but boy, I want to make sure that if there's something legislatively we can suggest this year to clear the pathway for these open flexibility issues, I'd like to jump right on that.
Great. So we need to dig in more detail and get Mr. Dill to help us through that. I think from the conversations that I had heard last year on the assessment changes that people were interested in, there may be some flexibility now with what's in ESSA and federal law that they may want to revisit. Maybe not. I don't want to speak for them. But there's some flexibility there that we didn't have last year. In terms of the accountability changes and what we can add into our accountability system, I think, and this was just quick, and we need to dig in. I don't necessarily know that we need statutory change to be able to do it. I think we might be able to do it through state board rule, but it may be a conversation they want to have regardless, too.
Yes.
So there's a lot for us to dig in and figure out there.
We don't want to come in on the backside of that.
Absolutely.
And then one more question. The 7 pilot programs, mm-hmm. I know this is all new, but was there a timeline for that, for application?
I know. I read through it last night. I'm trying to remember. I don't think they said the year that they'll take.
I don't think so. They just
they just said it, too.
Yeah. Okay.
Just keep your eye open.
Keep your eye open.
Yes.
560. It's on page 500. I know. I pulled out the page number for you last night. Well, like
you're making things up.
Yeah, it was like 300. I don't remember.
We've updated ourselves with the first one is the Magnificent Seven. So we'd like to be
But that's definitely something, like, as we'll talk about later today, and you all have been already hearing about. We've been trying to position ourselves so we're ready to go with that if that's something you all want to move forward with.
Thank you.
So there's no Title I portability of funds. So that means all the students who live in various places across the state but attend a school in a different district, none of that funding follows them. It stays in their home district.
It's pretty much the same rule. So we do have some flexibility in how we allocate Title I funds, and we're trying to take advantage of that through multi-district online project. And we do make adjustments for our Charter School Institute and Colorado School for the Deaf and the Blind. So we're going to try and dig into what flexibility we do have and try and move forward with that flexibility. But there were no changes, significant changes to how it's
I'll be
allocated.
Interested to hear how that pilot is working. Yeah. And this identify at least once every 3 years and address. Mm-hmm. Seems really vague. The identify part, of course, is not. But what the address part?
It gets more specific in the law. We didn't want to bog you down with all that today.
We don't want to go there.
Well, yeah, but basically it talks about LEA and like district responsibility first, and then if progress isn't made, then what the state does. And we can get into that more with you as we dig in and share all those pieces.
It would be similar to how we're using the UIP right now. Okay. Where as part of the UIP process, they would address those areas where they weren't really meeting expectations.
Okay. Thank you.
Dr. Flores?
Dr. Shovel?
Yeah, thank you. So I'm glad if the reauthorization affords us a little bit of flexibility. My concern, of course, is that it continues to drive policy through grants and waivers. And as we look at what's discretionary and what we have to do, we should be apprised of that. And I'm still sorting through it, quite a tome for a document. But a couple things that concern me. Still requires the state education plans have to comply with 11 existing federal standards. Secretary of Education still has to sign off. Expands the role of government in preschool substantially in Section 9212, adds another $1 billion in preschool, and all the data collection that goes with that, linking post-secondary and labor data and newborn screening and health data systems, the Early Learning Challenge Grant, cradle-to-grave system of government data collection, data gathering information is replete in this document. Also, the Section 1005, trying to get through that, looks at types of assessments and includes subjective assessments of student skills and psychological attributes. And I think we should really look at that deeply, including attitudes, feelings, values, motivations. And then it incentivizes schools to be community learning centers, which on the face of it sounds good, but when you look at the kinds of offerings, healthcare, wellness programs, environmental literacy, promised neighborhoods, social, health, nutrition, mental health services. I mean, it really is very additive in terms of the role of government and education and those agendas insinuated into neighborhoods through schools. So as we look at how the government's using grants and waivers to continue its incursion into states' rights and local control, we should be very savvy about how we look at this document.
Yeah, there is one provision, I think, that was in the House version that did make it into the Senate version that was really ultimately passed that does prohibit the U.S. Department of Education from using grants as incentives to get states to sort of like, you know, with Race to the Top, where we'll give you a race to the top if you do this. It prohibits, and it's not quite sure how much it prohibits, but there's an attempt to limit that kind of behavior.
I saw the language, but then when I looked at what they were actually incentivizing, it seemed counterintuitive, inconsistent. Thank you.
Okay. Have you or could you, when we went through Race to the Top, a lot of those concepts were embedded in state statute. Mm-hmm. Have you identified any of those that might be, that are in state statute that would be an impediment to our taking full advantage of any opportunities that might be presented by this bill?
There is nothing that I saw off the bat that said, like I said, oh, we've got this in state law that won't allow us to do that, to do anything that gives us more flexibility in ESSA. I think there's more flexibility that we may want to explore in state law, or others may want to explore in state law now that there's some more freedom. in ESSA, but I don't think there's any stark impediments. But
those
again,
things
we need
that
to
would give us more flexibility.
Yeah.
We should be in a position as soon as practical to advise the legislature on what those changes might be.
Absolutely.
Working through the legislative committee to see if we have ideas that would increase flexibility, we should take those across the street. I think also we really want to avoid getting trapped into any of the things that Dr. Scheffel mentioned and accepting money that moves us in that direction and or any regulatory scheme that comes out of this department that would move us in that direction should be minimized. And I'd like whenever we do any plan submission to the federal government, if any of that sort of thing is included in a new expansion of the role or what we're trying to get schools to do, to be flagged so we have an opportunity to object to those provisions if for some client. Yes, Ms. Rankin?
Along those same lines, if there's anything already in place that the flexibility at the local level allows it to be taken away and that's of interest, we should know what that is.
I think the lens of which
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
If there's flexibility to take away things at the local level that they want to do away with or haven't funded yet and are having difficulty, the local, keeping it as local as possible would be the way to go, but not just on the growth, but also on the repeal, I guess, would be the... That's it. Something for the legal department. Thank you.
I have just one question. I think it's a stupid question, but in all of these numbers that you have $100,381. I presume that's $100 million.
Yes.
I couldn't imagine the federal government finding a number that small. Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate it. You got through that in an orderly fashion. Let's see, the next item we have will last one. We have an hour booked for it. What's the little break? We'd prefer a little break. Let's take 5 minutes, and then we'll proceed with item 15, the rules for the administration of high school equivalency. So we'll send a recess for 5 minutes. Sorry.
It's okay. Thank you.
Got you there just in time.
I'll take the 5 minutes. It's great.
Take five.